Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Manners Will Take You Where Brains and Money Won't, Wisdom from Mama and 35 Years at NASA, by Donald G. James with Captain Dennis D. James. Foreword by Congressman Eric Swalwell. Narrated by Donald G. James. In Loving Memory of Our Mother, Muriel Yvonne Gassett James. Foreword. My friend Donald James seems like a man from another better time. He's a man of science, of education, of service, and of course, of manners. Since the day we met, I've been deeply impressed and inspired by the leadership he shows and the life he leads. NASA was lucky to have his expertise and leadership for so long. I wish Congress had more people like him. Donald and his brother Dennis argue here that manners are much more than etiquette, politeness, civility, and protocol. Rather, they write, manners are the authentic and genuine way in which one shows up in the world for good, a foundation for fulfillment and meaning. For them, manners are a moral dimension and a virtue. From its inception, NASA has been a nexus of our nation's innovation and a sort of civic telescope for seeing mankind's future. As the education director at the Ames Research Center, and then as NASA's Associate Administrator for Education, Donald led the effort to inspire the next generation of scientists, engineers, and explorers. In this book, he imparts the wisdom he gained during his long and distinguished career. He hopes to inspire even more young people to attain fulfillment and meaning by finding their own NASAs through which to make the world a better place. And he hopes to inspire parents to consider the wisdom that was imparted to him and his brother by their late mother, Muriel Yvonne Gassett James. Give the people around you nothing but reasons to help you. Don't mistake this for some milquetoast go-along-to-get-along philosophy. Being consistently genuine, polite, and principled is a learned skill and hard work. It requires you to step outside your comfort zone, to subvert your reflexive impulse to hit back, and to constantly think about how to stay on the higher ground. It is, in many ways, a spiritual undertaking and a journey that never ends. So as you read this book, try to think about how its lessons fit into your daily life. How do you present yourself to your colleagues, to your ideological allies and adversaries, to the myriad people you meet in your daily life? How do the words you speak and the actions you take reflect upon you and advance your goals? There's some element of the golden rule at play here. Are you being the kind of person with whom you would want to live and work? I'm grateful that my parents taught me, as Donald and Dennis's mama taught them, that being kind and honest is never wrong, and that unless rules apply to all of us, they're not really rules at all. As a father of two young kids, I believe we all owe the same to our children, and I'm glad there are people like Donald and Dennis writing books like this to help us along. Today's America too often feels like a perpetual shouting match in which opponents face off with no respect for each other's knowledge or motive and with no regard for truth and facts. Too many strive only to gain and to win, not for what's right and just. Too many principled disagreements are turned into unprincipled all-or-nothing showdowns. There's an oft-used exhortation to be the change you want to see in the world. That's Donald James to a T. And the truth is, America needs more Donald Jameses. That he lives in the congressional district I represent is a source of pride. That he lives in our nation is a source of hope. I have every confidence that this Quiet Heroes book will help inspire others to follow his example for a more civil and honest country in which principled public service toward a greater good receives the praise it so richly deserves. Congressman Eric Swalwell. Introduction. My NASA Career, The Beginning. "Phone, Don," my dad shouted from upstairs, waking me up. The blackout curtains made it easy for me to sleep late, never knowing if the sun was out or not. It was another hot, muggy summer day in Bethesda, Maryland. I went to the den to get the phone, still a bit foggy. "Hi, Donald. This is James. James Snyder from Goddard." I'd met James the day before at my interview at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. It was 1982, and I was fresh out of graduate school and still living with my dad, my stepmother, and their two children. I was a newly minted presidential management intern, and Goddard had sent me a letter asking me to apply. NASA was not my first choice for where I wanted to work in the federal government. I had just earned a master's degree in international development and wanted to save the world from the scourges of poverty and economic destitution. To this day, I don't know why NASA plucked my resume out of the pile of PMIs, as we were known. Perhaps they dug deep into my academic history to learn that I'd studied aerospace engineering in college, but that seemed improbable. I'd majored in aero for only a year before switching to international relations in my sophomore year. My father had convinced me to do the interview, even if I didn't plan to work at NASA. He said practicing interviewing was important, and that the best way to learn is to do. So I did. I had been honest with the NASA interviewers. I shared my desire to secure a position with the U.S. Agency for International Development or the U.S. Department of State. I said I would definitely keep NASA in mind. I was sincere about that. "Donald, I am pleased to let you know that we are extending you a job offer." "Our interview team was pretty impressed," James announced. I considered my response carefully, still clearing cobwebs after a long night's sleep. I thanked James for the call and the offer. I said I was honored. I told him that I wanted to think about it as I was still looking at working in the international development field. I probably said, "I'll get back to you," a cliche phrase often heard as code for, "He isn't calling back." The next morning, James called again, asking me if I had thought about it. I gave the same answer as the day before. This went on for 3 days straight. On day four, my father said, in his usual diplomatic way, after all, he was a diplomat, "Son, you may want to consider taking this offer. It's an actual job, you know." His suggestion included a not-so-subtle reminder that my efforts to take my newly earned PMI badge of honor to the United States Agency for International Development, or the State Department, was not bearing fruit. I had nothing, and NASA was offering. "You can always work at NASA for 3 to 5 years, get some solid experience, and then try to transfer to do what you want to do." It was a reasonable strategy and good advice. I called James that day to accept. I didn't reveal my strategy to do this for 3 to 5 years and then move on to save the world from the scourges of poverty and economic destitution. I had a plan, or so I thought. Several months later, I received some interesting feedback from James about my job interview. Apparently, I had done everything properly. He commented on how I dressed compared to one of the other interviewees. I'd worn a dark suit, a red tie, and a white shirt. My shoes were polished, and I sported a fresh, clean haircut. In the profound words of Tyler Perry's Madea character from the movie Madea's Family Reunion, I was casket sharp. James confided that another interviewee had arrived with a bit of a swagger, sporting sunglasses, an open-collared shirt, a blazer, and a gold chain around his neck. I got the impression that his attire alone may have doomed his interview. James also talked about my responses to their questions. He said it was both what I said and how I'd said it. He implied that I was responsive to the questions, to the point, and sufficiently self-deprecating to inoculate myself against arrogance. He went on to share what the Goddard interviewers, including him, had thought about my overall performance in their post-interview assessment after I'd left the office. What amazed me were the things they apparently noticed. It didn't seem to matter that I couldn't calculate aspect ratios or delta Vs or solve a differential equation to save my life. What did matter? Well, that is the point of this book. I believe manners made the difference. I ended up working at NASA for 35 years, ascending to the highest level the United States federal government civil servant can reach. I began as a mid-level civil servant working in procurement at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and I ended my career as a senior executive, serving as the Associate Administrator for Education at NASA headquarters. In between, I moved back to California and worked in public affairs and education at NASA's Ames Research Center. I enjoyed challenging and fascinating projects and worked with and for incredibly smart people. My career launch upward began in 2004 when I was accepted into the Senior Executive Service Candidate Development Program. This program was the way NASA trained its next generation of senior leaders. With the support of many, some perseverance, and guidance from the universe's gracious power, I managed to rise to the top rung of NASA leadership. At the end of my career, there was only one person separating me from the President of the United States. How was this possible for a man with a B average, modest SAT scores, and degrees in international relations and economics? I want to emphasize something that I strongly believe. A former boss and someone I consider a mentor and key to my growth at NASA once said, "There are many paths to the throne." I didn't appreciate his wisdom at first, but the words stuck with me. Here's what I believe about that statement. There is no one right way to a fulfilling career in life. There is no one answer. But good manners can hold a significant place in the journey. The domain of manners can be viewed similarly to the domain of space exploration. Space exploration can include a lot of things, and it has many subsets and overlaps. Examples include human exploration, space science, planetary geology, astronomy, astrobiology, and exobiology. There's a lot inside the box. Manners are like that. Manners reflect the way people show up to others and to themselves. They are the way in which we exist. NASA. Without the lessons my mama taught me, I wouldn't have made it as far as I did in my NASA career, which culminated in my dream job as Associate Administrator for Education. Manners and proper English, both verbally and in writing, were a big deal for Mama. As an English and French teacher, Mama insisted on proper, respectful conventions. She taught at a school that had many immigrant students, particularly from Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. She insisted on calling her students by their birth names and pronouncing them correctly. She was also convinced that a dangling participle, an uncombed afro, or an unacknowledged gift were life's debris. "It's your neighborhood," she would say. "Keep it clean and right so they can't use it against you." What she meant by "they" were people who could help you or harm you. "Do not give anyone a reason to harm you," she would say. "Give them a reason to help you." Mama believed the key to success lies not in how book smart you are or how rich, but in how you treat people and how you show up in the world. Our prisons are populated with smart people. The world is full of unhappy people who have a lot of money. Mama didn't lecture. She just showed up in her truth and let her wisdom ooze out over time. As a young, naive NASA hire, if I wasn't the smartest guy in the room, and I certainly was not, or the most experienced, for certain, I did know how to engage people and carry myself in a way that usually engendered cordiality, respect, and trust. I had good manners, albeit with occasional lapses in judgment. Doors opened that may have remained shut had I shown poor manners, which often equal poor judgment. Opportunities presented themselves that may have been mysteriously absent had I assumed that my knowledge, skills, abilities, or credentials alone would carry the day. People were willing, at some risk to their own reputation, to help, endorse, or support me along the way, enabling me to reach my dream job at NASA, a job for which I competed against more than 80 candidates. Toward the end of my career, I became interested in sharing what I learned from my NASA and non-NASA trainings. During a question and answer session, a young man asked me how I might advise my 25-year-old self if I could go back in time, knowing what I know now. "Great question," I replied. After some thought, I answered, "I would tell young Donald to say yes more to opportunities and to really work on his manners." What do I mean by manners? I'm speaking of more than just civility, etiquette, or politeness. Though manners encompass a broad range of skills, manners are actually more than simply learned skills. Manners are a way of being that is rooted in one's essence. Everyone has a view about the right way to be, what good behavior is, or what's acceptable in the home, school, or workplace. The dynamics and values of human interaction evolve. Rules, policies, standards, and conventions of what is acceptable change. Manners can be situational, and they can also shift over time. What may have been bad manners when I began my career, like not wearing a tie to work, may be acceptable now. What might have been tolerated then, jokes of a racial or sexual nature, isn't now. When I speak about manners, I'm not talking about please and thank you. I'm talking about good or appropriate manners for our time, the second and third decade of the third millennium. My view of manners is quite broad, as I hope this book reveals. The book's organization, Story as Teaching. Because of my experience as a former NASA leader, early career professionals have sought my advice about advancement and making it in the world, particularly at a place like NASA. Invariably, the talks and speeches I offer include lessons from Mama, especially the lesson that became the title of this book, Manners Will Take You Where Brains and Money Won't. Although I've written this book primarily for early career professionals, it is my hope that it will also inspire and support high school students and college students on their journeys. My intention is that this book will benefit anyone who reads it, whether they fit those target audience categories or not. Perhaps just viewing the world through the lens of manners will open new possibilities for opportunity, fulfillment, and meaning. In this book, I draw on stories, both personal and from my experiences at NASA, that serve to illustrate a manners point or one of Mama's rules. These rules are listed at the start of Chapter 1, and we will delve into them throughout the book. Each chapter opens with a story that illustrates to some degree the point of that chapter. This is not a scholarly book. I will simply strive to point out where I've been directly influenced by others. My messages emerge from the synthesis of my experience, training, and learning. My training was not limited to NASA. I have always been and continue to be a learning junkie. In my 20s and early 30s, I was introduced to two deeply impactful and personally meaningful trainings. The first was the EST training seminar created by Werner Erhard, and the second was an intense gathering called the Men's Weekend, created by A. Justin Sterling. Both were somewhat controversial. My experience with them was powerful and life-affirming, and they profoundly shaped my worldview and my manners. A note about some of the book's conventions. I use pseudonyms in most stories and references. Actual names are not critical for the story's purpose. In some cases, I use actual names because the listener could easily learn an identity. For example, it would be silly for me not to use the names of the NASA administrator or deputy administrator because anyone can find that out. I refer to black people as black instead of African American. This is just my preference. It reveals when I came of age and when I became more conscious of my race. Once upon a time, black people were referred to as colored, then Negroes, then Afro-American, then black, then African-American. We were called other things, too, throughout history, mostly derogatory. I prefer black because black is what I was in my formative years, and that is how I now identify. I am black because much of society sees me as black. I am black because I like being black, even though I'm lighter complexion than my dad and darker complexion than my children. And for transparency, please note that Mama wasn't the original author of many of her rules about how to live in the world. I know, for example, that rule number 8 came from either Dr. Seuss or Colombian writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I'm certain I have come across some of her other rules in my readings. Many aphorisms are timeless, universal kernels of wisdom that have long been repeated in the general culture. It is my intention that by the time you finish listening to this book, you might have discovered a few nuggets of wisdom that are actionable for your journey. Some of the topics we'll cover include the following. Manners. An appreciation of manners as much more than being polite and behaving civilly, but as a way to walk in the world with integrity, respect, mindfulness, and compassion. Pink suits. The importance of considering ideas, behaviors, or actions that fall outside your comfort zone, long enough to see if they make a positive difference. Money, possessions, success, and achievement. Greater awareness of what matters to you beyond these concepts. Mama's rules. Not only understanding what they are, but how they may apply to you and how you can develop your own rules that serve your specific journey. Interviewing. Being prepared for the interview you didn't know you were having. Appreciating that, in a way, you're always being interviewed. Building your team. The value of having a team in your life to support you. Decisions and consequences. Becoming better prepared to handle injustices that may invade your life. With a cacophony of voices and libraries of books telling you what you should do to be successful, why on earth should this book be any different? Perhaps something I write about or the way I say it will resonate with you. If we connect on just one thing, then this book will have been worth it. Preface. COVID-19. After I finished the draft of this book in early 2020, the world experienced an unprecedented event, the coronavirus, or COVID-19 pandemic. As you listen to these words, I suspect the pandemic is still being felt. My heart is heavy over the loss of life and the life-changing impact it has had on so many people worldwide. The pandemic changed our behavior overnight, from physical distancing to quarantining to enhanced hygienic measures, not to mention the cessation of a vast portion of the economy. The pandemic, as well as more recent social unrest, inspired me to rethink the relevance of this book's message. As you listen to these words, you may know some of the answers to the questions I currently have. Will a vaccine save the day? Will we all go back to business as usual? Will the economy ravaged by this virus recover? How will our interactions with each other change? Will exposed societal inequities and social justice matters be addressed? Though I don't yet know the answers to these questions, after much consideration, I still believe that the messages and principles in this book apply. Only you can determine how the principles might apply to you for today, tomorrow, and beyond. In Chapter 4, Pink Suits, I talk about stepping out of our comfort zone and trying on a metaphorical pink suit as a new way to approach an issue. The coronavirus has forced the entire world to put on one big, bright pink suit. For me, maintaining a 6-foot distance from those that I love and wearing surgical gloves and a face mask in public while hunting for toilet paper and hand sanitizer, while essentially remaining under quarantine for a few months, is a whole closet full of pink suits. The virus is like the wind. We can't see it, but we experience its impact. Another significant change is the near ubiquitous use of online or virtual gatherings, whether for business, education, or social activities. This includes interviewing for a job. Chapter 8, Am I Being Interviewed?, focuses on the job interview, but is biased toward the face-to-face interview. During our shelter-in-place edicts to thwart the spread of the virus, if an interview is taking place, it's probably on the phone or via the computer. How could the environment of a virtual meeting impact the outcome of an interview? Well, for starters, it's more challenging to read someone's body language, and impossible if it's a phone interview. The quality of the audio and video may be poor and include lag times and distortions. The interviewee may need to be extra mindful to look naturally into their computer's camera versus off to the side at their screen, and to ensure there are no visual or auditory distractions. After adjusting to my new reality during the shelter-in-place period, I was struck hard and embarrassed when I finally comprehended the pandemic's devastation. Tens of thousands of lives lost, tens of millions unemployed, families crushed, no loved ones allowed at a dying relative's bedside, virtual funerals, weddings, and religious services, not to mention distance education and widespread teleworking. Travel all but stopped, businesses shuttered, many of which may never come back. I often equate the enormity of the situation to the proverbial asteroid that has smashed into Earth. Fear, anxiety, and helplessness dominate the emotions of many. How will humanity adapt and cope? I asked myself during the most sobering moments of COVID-19, which parts of manners are still relevant? My instincts led me to the story I share in Chapter 12, Money, Brains, and Success, about the magic money exercise, which invites us to take a second look at money and what it means to us. During the time of the shelter in place, while taking a walk alone in the park and enjoying the quiet sounds of the living earth, I often meditated on the rules my late mama, Muriel James, taught me. And with a deep inhalation of clean air, I rejoice that I have another day to give. Donald G. James, Pleasanton, California. Chapter 1, Mama's Rules. Muriel's 8 Cardinal Rules of Life. Number 1, make peace with your past so it won't screw up the present. Number 2, what others think of you is none of your business. Number 3, time heals almost everything. Give it time. Number 4, don't compare your life to others. And don't judge others. You have no idea what their journey is about. Number 5. Stop thinking too much. It's all right not to know the answers. They will come to you when you least expect it. Number 6. No one is in charge of your happiness except you. Number 7. Smile. You don't own all the problems in the world. Number 8. Don't cry because it's over. Smile because it happened. One day, Mama, a child of the Great Depression and ever the frugal person, drove herself to her neighborhood Dollar Tree store. To Mama, the next depression was always around the corner. At the time of this particular outing, she was about 85 and getting feebler, although
sample complete. Ready to continue?